Hello, this is David Rovix with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing most every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovix.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT every weekday, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovix.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovix, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after their broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovix. Today, I'm honored to have with me for the hour musician, professor, and author Will Kaufman. Will teaches at the University of Central Lancashire in England and writes a whole lot of books, among many other activities. He's an accomplished multi-instrumentalist and sings the songs of the folks he writes books about as well. In 2011, he wrote Woody Guthrie, American Radical, and since then, I have just discovered this morning, he has written two other books about the life and times of Woody Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's Modern Blues in 2017, and Mapping Woody Guthrie in 2019. Before the pandemic, in addition to writing and teaching, Will also traveled extensively, doing what he calls live documentaries on various themes. Will Kaufman, welcome to my live stream show. Great to have you. Yep. Well, you mentioned in an email that you haven't played the guitar in months, and I'm just wondering, it leads me to wonder how the pandemic is treating you, and you probably had tours canceled, and how's online teaching? Could we just start with there?
Okay. The pandemic is, in a sense, treating me okay, because the enforced lockdown is enabling me to focus on my book in progress, and I think that also explains why I'm not doing much guitar playing, because when I'm really locked into writing, I can't spread myself too thin. I don't know. I just want to sit and write all day, and then I'm just so tired that I just veg out in front of the television after a day of writing. So I've let the side down, but I haven't been practicing for weeks. Now, normally I live in England here. I'm in Yorkshire. And
it's Yorkshire. You teach in Lancashire, but you live in Yorkshire. Okay.
I teach in Lancashire, but I'm across the border, from the White Rose to the Red Rose counties, back and forth, And on Tuesday nights, I used to go up every Tuesday night to a session, an Irish session up the hill from me, because you've been here, you've visited Hebden Bridge,
many times. Beautiful.
Yeah, and so we did have an Irish session that I would play at every Tuesday night in the old White Lion up in Hepton Stall. But since the pandemic, I haven't felt quite safe to get out into pubs and things like that. Not quite ready for that yet. So,
and you've been too busy with your new writing project to bother with doing live stream concerts and stuff like that. I mean, you're very project oriented when you're writing. You're just working on it for just all the time.
I just get locked into it that way.
Which is a good way to do pandemics, I think. If you're used to the 9-to-5 job, it's tough. But if you have a project and you can just be immersed in it, that's probably helpful.
Exactly. And as far as teaching goes, I mean, I was off when the pandemic kicked in. I was on leave when the pandemic kicked in, so I didn't have to do any online teaching, but I will the next semester in the autumn when it picks up again. I'm going to be doing all my teaching online. I haven't done that before yet, so I'm hoping it'll work out, but I have no idea. I haven't tried yet.
It'll work well. You'll just want to get a good USB mic, and then you're good to go. As far as I can tell from the connection we've got right now, I'd say you'll be fine.
Does the sound suck?
No, it's good. It's good. But you'd sound better with a good USB mic or something closer to your mouth. You know, I mean, it sounds fine. The sound is all over the place with these things. You see it when you watch TV these days, too. You know, everybody's got all kinds of the people they're interviewing are in all sorts of different situations, which is kind of interesting. And there's a whole new art form to analyzing the bookshelves of people, you know, because that's the most common backdrop.
Yeah. Oh, we're very strategic in where we place our devices.
Yeah, the bookshelves are good. Unmade beds, not so good.
No. I got that down already. I've got that. Yeah.
Can I ask you what you're working on? What's the book that you're working on?
The book right now is, as you mentioned, I've done three books on Woody Guthrie now. I've written three books, and I'm kind of all woodied out at the moment.
That's enough. Yeah.
And yeah. And so what I'm working on now actually is a book that was prompted by hearing so many well-meaning people and champions of Woody Guthrie, Billy Bragg and others, refer to him as, you know, the father of American protest music, which you and I know, and even Woody himself would demur at that one. He would not agree with that. So what I'm working on is a book with the working title Before Woody Guthrie. It's like BC, you know.
Before, oh, nice.
BWG, you know, before Woody Guthrie, and it's a study of, I guess I would call it, song and struggle. I don't like protest music as a phrase that's a bit too. I don't want to dance on the head of a pin trying to define it, you know, so I just say song and struggle in America from 1492, really from the, you know, the first Colombian invasion right up to 1940 when Woody shows up, just to indicate that song and struggle have been, you know, inseparable partners in America and everywhere else, you know, but that's my area. My wheelhouse is American studies.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're writing that book. I guess it's a question of whether people read it, or, I mean, because it's not like, I mean, because of course the concept is out there, including from books you've already written, like the book on the songs of the American peace movement, which goes way back to the, yeah, that one. And yeah, you start that one begins before the revolution.
That's right. And it ends with David Rovics, if you recall.
I know. I'm all over that last chapter. That's the best last chapter of a book I've ever read.
So to plug it, it's called Singing for Peace, Anti-War Songs in American History. And I co-wrote it with Ronald D. Cohen, who folks may know is the leading scholar of the folk music, really the revival. But even before that, you know, he's written stuff now that goes, he's labor song, history, songs of the Depression, the British and American folk revival. He's really the one who, I guess, is the dean of American folk music scholarship. So he's a friend, he's a good friend, and my mentor in many ways. And to have actually co-written a book with him is a real badge of honor for me. So,
this new book you're working on is a more broader survey of music from.
Yeah, I call it Song and Struggle. Yeah. So it's looking at, you know, I mean, when you think of the Colombian invasion and then Cortez and how music played a part in the conquest of the Americas and also resistance to that conquest, and indigenous music and struggles to silence the indigenous musical voice, settler colonial attempts to either silence that voice or co-opt it or Christianize it, or various things that have happened before the arrival of protest songwriters and things like that. So it's, you know, I don't know how long the book is going to be. I've written completed six chapters. I'm on the seventh chapter now. I must have written about, 60,000 words or more, you know, on it. And it's a strange thing, because usually when you're thinking of a book project, you approach a publisher having, you know, drawn up a an outline and maybe a table of contents and maybe a sample chapter or something like that. And I can't do any of that because I have no idea what it's going to look like, how long it's going to be, if I can, you know, how many volumes, I just don't know. So
it's, because you're exploring the material that's out there and finding out just what is out there. I mean, this is, it sounds like you're doing a lot of research that, on stuff that hasn't been done before. You're not, you're working with first, what do you call it? Not secondhand material here. You're doing a lot of that.
There is primary, a lot of primary material, and there is some secondary material in places you wouldn't think to find it. You know, so for instance, a lot of my sources are from histories of, you know, Native American history, things like that, where songs are mentioned, but not necessarily in books about music. You know, so I'm finding my songs in a whole bunch of strange places. You know, but a narrative is coming together. You know, so.
When the mainstream press and other folks, like a lot of other folks, talk about what they call protest music, they often it's often like it all began with Bob Dylan, or it all began with Woody Guthrie, and occasionally it all began with Joe Hill, and none of those things is true, of course, right? No. It's rarely occasionally do you hear that it all began with Joe Hill, because usually most people talking about this stuff think that the 1930s was really the beginning of any kind of left-wing consciousness. Like, and what is that? Why is that? That's just because there were bigger movements happening during those times, or the music industry didn't really exist per se before?
Also recording, you know, the fact is that most of these, for instance, the most comprehensive study of protest music that I've ever seen, I think, is Dorian Lynskey's book, 33 Revolutions Per Minute, right? It's published, it's a huge book. It's, it must be about 250,000 words. It's, you know, about, I don't know, 500 or 600 pages or something. It's published by, I think it's Faber. And it begins with the writing of Strange Fruit, 1939, you know. So, and the title is an indication, 33 Revolutions Per Minute. So really he is relying completely on protest songs that have come with the age of sound recording. Well, if you just look at American history, you know, the abolition movement and the Hutchinson family singers and the Fisk Jubilee singers, you know, taking spirituals. I mean, these were the super groups of their day, but they never recorded on disc. So before the advent of recording, I'm going into sheet music. You know, I'm going on through, you know, the Library of Congress has amazing sheet music collections that are accessible online. There are various bibliographies and catalogs of sheet music. And then, you know, secondary works on the history of popular music and popular song. There's a lot of stuff in there. So histories of broadside ballads, colonial broadside ballads, and early 19th century broadside ballads, you know, 18th, 19th century, 17th century as well, you know. So it's the stuff is there. It's just never been looked at in one comprehensive study of song and struggle, you know. It's always been looked at in some other context. So my bibliography must be about 30 pages single space now, you know. But we're getting there.
When you look at collections of just like child ballads, or, you know, the child's not being, for those who don't know, that's the last name of a collector, not children's, you know. Francis Child, yeah. And you find that, and the stuff that Lomax collected, and so much else, it seems like a very large percentage of what just people were writing about over the course of centuries has been what we might characterize as political.
Yes.
Even if it's not like they're not collected together in that context, right? But it's and then the music industry comes along. Depending on where you measure it, like a century ago or 130 years ago or something like that, right? I don't know exactly where you say the music industry started, but it had a huge impact on how we think about music and what people write about and what people don't write about, would you say? I mean, I know it's a massive subject, but...
I mean, the music industry, unless I've got this wrong, for me, the music industry begins with the printed sheet music industry for providing homes as soon as the pianoforte or the piano is situated in a middle-class home. You begin to have an industry that provides fodder for that. And a lot of the songs that are printed from, say, I'd say, I mean, before the, I probably got my dates not quite right here, but I'd say that before the 1830s, you're probably dealing mostly with broadside ballads. Now, I mean, there is an industry of broadside ballads, as I suppose. You've got songsters back in the 1830s and 40s in America, at least songsters. So these are cheap pocket-sized collections of lyrics that they usually didn't have music, but they are incredibly political. I mean, one of the nastiest examples I've ever saw was called the Old Rough and Ready Songster, named after Zachary Taylor, the general who, basically started the Mexican-American War. And there are all these political songsters that go along with that, the Rough and Ready Songster, which has all these horrible songs about we're going to, we're going to raid Mexico and take all their land from them and push the greasers into the Rio Grande and things like that, you know? So there's a lot of songsters that champion Davy Crockett and things like that as part of the settler colonial arsenal, the music.
So they were put out there to be tools of sort of propaganda tools for empire.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. These are part of the imperial, arsenal. And I think also and combating that, for instance, you would have, America's first supergroup probably would be the Hutchinson Family Singers, which were a New Hampshire group of abolitionists and women's rights activists and anti-imperialists. I mean, they were incredibly political, the Hutchinson Family Singers, and they traveled all over the North. They didn't do so well in the South in the antebellum years and during the Civil War. Obviously, it's like Abraham Lincoln not appearing on the ballot in the South. You know, they didn't get get any gigs in the South themselves, but they used music. Musical activists. It's an incredible history we have of musical activism in America, and the War of Independence, before that, the French and Indian Wars, or even King Philip's War, or the Powhatan Uprising of 1622 in Jamestown. They all produced ballads, and they all produced, and they're not just ballads about what happened. They're ballads about what the hell we're going to do about these. Salvages, these savages who would dare to resist our incursion. Well, we're going to draft in some ballad writers in order to nail our flags to that mast. So, and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of ballads, broadside ballads appearing that chronicle the wars of conquest. It's not only wars. I mean, there's a woman's movement, working class resistance that pick up the baton from the Wat Tyler Rebellion of the 1300s, and those kind of strains of resistance get trans transferred to the Americas, and the class struggle keeps on going there. And there are ballads to reflect that, you know, outlaw ballads, breaking someone out of jail because, like, if you know the old ballad, Billy Broke Locks. Mm. That's about somebody springing somebody out of jail during the anti-rent wars, and things that you've written about, or you've you know, on your timelines, you've got like a song a day kind of thing, don't you? I can't remember what it is, but
yeah, song for today.
History through song, you know.
Yeah.
So, but the thing is, like, yours are all. You're writing them yourself, aren't you? And you know, because there are so many Rovick songs that I could use. And
you're looking for songs from the period more.
So, for instance, you know, the one that you do, that great song about the St. Patrick's Brigade, you know. Mm-hmm. St. Patrick's Battalion, about the American, the Irish, and they weren't only Irish, they were also German and even some Poles. Yeah,
and even at least when I looked at the name at the plaque in Mexico City the place where they used to, where the convent that many of them lived, who survived and went to Mexico City, there were unmistakably Polish names list. You know,
they were So they deserted, as you know, and from the U.S. Army and joined the Mexican side, as you sing it. Well, you know, I would have loved to have been able to use your songs or some of the, you know, the Chieftain's Rye Cooter stuff, but it's a bit, they were written a little bit after the fact.
A little bit after.
But I did find one that was discovered. A ballad that supposedly was written at Chapultepec, which is where most of the San Patricios were wiped out, and it's a song called "Buck and Gag Him," and it's written from the point of view, maybe even written by one of the soldiers who you know, it explains why you would desert, even beyond for political reasons, because of the sadism that you're faced, you know, that you receive, that you're the victim of officers. And at one point, so to buck and gag someone is what they used to do, is as for the smallest, and you know, for the smallest transgression, they would pin you spread eagled out in the sun, you know, tie your hand to stakes driven into the sand, that's being bucked, and then they'd gag you, they'd shove a gag into your mouth and leave you out into the sun for the smallest of transgressions, you know. And at the end he says, and this is why the Mexican ranks are being filled up with Americans, because they're, you know, so, and then the fact that that was found at precisely where it was that the San Patricios were wiped out, you know, one can propose that there is a bit of a connection, or at least a fellowship, between whoever it was who wrote that song and the San Patricios themselves, you know.
When I was looking at a collection of songs from the anti-fascist side in the Spanish Civil War, it seemed like the more sort of politically pure songs are the ones that survived, and so many of the songs that I found, which I had never heard before, were songs about how much it sucks to be in the army or in any army and to deal with all the just, you know, all the daily horrors and problems of just life in the army. And then a lot of the other stuff was pretty overtly racist or anti-Moorish anyway, you know, because so many of the Franco's troops were Moors. So yeah, it was very interesting to see which bits survive and which bits don't.
Yeah. Do you know, Woody Guthrie wrote a bunch of songs about, he wrote songs against Franco. I wrote an article about it, which is, I believe it's available. Yeah, it's available open access. So if you Google Woody Guthrie songs against Franco, and I found those in the Woody Guthrie archives, a little because Woody would write these songs and he'd make his own little, you know, makeshift notebook. And then, you know, he'd decorate the covers with watercolor wash and stuff like that. And so I found this neat little thing, Songs Against Franco. And it's I mean, written obviously long after the fact. I think he was writing them in the 1950s, I think, early 1950s, if I got that right.
Right. And Franco is still very much in power.
Still there. Yeah, yeah. So he's commenting on, you know, the guy that is still there. And I think maybe it's 1949, maybe when Woody is writing the songs against Franco. And, you know, he never published any of them, never recorded any of them. But they're there. He was on the case, you know.
He didn't publish or record them because basically of the conditions of the social movement at the time. I mean, it's his stuff from the 30s is more well known than anything else he wrote. Yes. And I assume that's because there was a huge social movement going on at the time, including, you know, entities like the Communist Party and the Councils of the Unemployed and so many others that were promoting his music along with other music that was speaking to the times.
Right. I mean, and even that would have been a pretty small fellowship. I mean, you know, Dust Bowl Ballads was probably what got him onto the public radar, into the national radar anyway. And that was 1940 that he recorded that. He had a very short recording career. He only recorded for about 12 years because when Huntington's disease kicked in around 1952, really, that's when it begins to show up. I mean, he's not completely disabled then. He's playing, you know, but I think, you know, by like 1956, he's certainly out of the picture as a recording artist. And some of that did coincide with the turning of the screws against the folk artists by, you know, McCarthy. McCarthyites in the F. In fact, I just got a great book and I pulled it out here so I could show you guys because I've read it in manuscript and I have a back cover blurb, but this has just been published, Aaron Leonard's The Folk Singers and the Bureau.
Uh-huh. And
it's all about the...
Excellent.
Where are you? Can you see
me? Oh, you're there. I can see you. Yeah, you're not... the screen got raised up a little bit. Now,
sure did.
There we go.
This thing is perched on like 15 books in a
excellent
in a partridge in a pear tree. Sorry about that.
Oop, we lost you there. Come back. There might have been a connection that got unplugged or something, but we'll probably get him back. And we are talking with Will Kaufman on Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, most Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays every week, along with other broadcasts I host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. All of these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix, on Patreon at patreon.com/davidrovix, and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. Will, you...
Panache as ever.
Oh, perfect. Perfect entrance. If you look up your name on Google, you'll find very quickly references to Donald Trump's father.
Yes.
And it was only after you published your first book about Woody Guthrie and did a really good speaking tour around the U.S., which is, I believe, where I know I heard you on National Public Radio at least two or three times, because I was traveling and touring around the U.S. performing while you were also doing your book tour. So I'd be listening to you know, NPR in different states, and I thought, oh, there's the guy who just wrote that book about Woody Guthrie again. And it was wonderful to get to hear several interviews with you, and it's just by accident, which is, you know, I would have been seeking them out, but that was when you come up by accident talking about Woody Guthrie, that was especially exciting for me as a traveling musician singing Woody songs. But then it was later that you discovered in some archival research some songs that Woody wrote about Fred Trump, and that Fred that Donald Trump's racist father was his landlord there.
Woody's landlord. Yeah, I mean the story of that was happened. I was researching for my second It's called Woody Guthrie's Modern World Blues. So I was researching for that, and that's about Woody and his relation to modernity in the modern world and how he responded to modernity. But I was researching for that book. I guess it was about maybe 2014, I think. I was back in the Woody Guthrie archives, which are now in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that's where they have all of his, well, huge, I mean, like 3,000 song manuscripts, you know, the majority of which were never recorded. And you know, his letters and his notebooks and his artwork. It's an amazing archive, the Woody Guthrie Archive. So I was in there, and I know that I was going to be doing a chapter about Woody and race. And so I was going through his letters and going through his notebooks, and I noticed that he, you know, had quite a beef with his landlord from 1950 to 1952 on the strength of the royalties from So Long It's Been Good to Know You, as recorded by the Weavers. He and his wife Marjorie and their at that time, yeah, three children, moved in to could get a larger apartment than what they had on Mermaid Avenue in Coney Island. So they found Beach Haven in Brooklyn, and it gave them a lot more space. And Woody loved it until he noticed that there weren't that many people of color walking around there. And he began to dig around and find out why. And it turned out that his landlord, Fred Trump, you know, was you know, sort of, you know, really actively enforcing the color line. And so I noticed that Woody just really got obsessed about Fred Trump. I mean, he didn't only write one song. He wrote a number of songs lambasting Fred Trump and letters calling him out and essays in his notebooks about racial hate at Beach Haven and Beach Haven race hate. And I don't like the way old man Trump is treating me and a whole bunch of things. So he got really obsessed with the racism of Fred Trump, particularly at a time when he was corresponding with his and visiting his friend Stetson Kennedy. I don't know how many folks watching would know who Stetson Kennedy was, a great anti-racist activist and folklorist from Florida, sort of a mentor to Zora Neale Hurston in anthropology and folklore collecting. And he wrote a wonderful book called The Jim Crow Guide to the USA. It's like a mock guidebook, really written for people of color. I mean, it's a satire in a sense. It says, this is the guidebook that will prevent you from getting killed if you want to travel in the United States. It's that kind of thing. He couldn't find a publisher for it, so Jean-Paul Sartre published it.
Oh, wow. It sounds related to the Green Book, I think it's called?
In a sense, the Green Book, no, it goes where the Green Book doesn't go, because the Green Book, I think, is a sort of a project that doesn't challenge Jim Crow, but enables it. It's an enabling book telling people, you know, look, you stay out here. Here's a safe place for you to go, you know, but it doesn't really challenge Jim Crow polemically, I don't think, whereas the Jim Crow Guide to the USA does, you know. So Woody used to go down and visit Stetson Kennedy quite a bit in his farm outside of Jacksonville, his ranch called Beloopahatchee. And so he's writing a lot of letters to Stetson Kennedy about this place he's landed, you know, Beach Haven. And he says, I'm living in the middle of a Jim Crow town. I can't believe it. Where as you call them, colored people are allowed to come in here and live freely, like, you know. And Fred Trump is his Jim Crow landlord and things like that. So I had all of those notes, a couple pages of notes, sitting on my laptop since 2014. And at that time, all I thought was, isn't that a curiosity? Woody's landlord was that loudmouth real estate reality TV guy's father. didn't care much about it. But then come, 2015, Christmas, or November, whenever it was, 2015, when that loudmouth reality guy is declaring himself candidate for the presidency, that's when I wrote an article which appeared in a news organ called The Conversation, which is where, it's like, what's their catchphrase? Academic rigor and journalistic flair. It's where for academics to take some of their, as scholars, to take some of their work and put it out in a user-friendly way to the public. So you're not just writing for other academics, So
nice.
So it's called The Conversation, and that's where that first thing, and then that's also a gatekeeping place for other news, magazines and sites to pick up, in a sense. It's been vetted by being, so all of it, because I submitted it to the New York Times, not interested. Submitted it to The Guardian, not interested.
In 2015?
I wrote it over Christmas 2015, so early 2016. They weren't interested in it, maybe because it was Christmas, but the Conversation wanted it. Mm. And so they published it in January 2016. And then, boom, it gets picked up by The Guardian. New York Times is writing about it. Washington Post, PBS, the radio, and it goes global.
Yeah.
And they're still talking about it now.
Anytime
there's a mention about, Donald Trump's racism, they're always bringing it back to his father. He learned at his dad's knee, and his dad was so racist that Woody Guthrie even wrote a song about it. That's coming around a lot now.
A lot. And now with Mary Trump's book, new round of attention to that.
There is. It showed up in an article recently in The Nation about how Disney, is like about Hamilton, when Disney started broadcasting Hamilton, the film of the musical Hamilton. And they're saying, well, even Disney's losing, owning up to its own racism. But Donald Trump certainly isn't. And do you know about Donald Trump's dad? Why, Woody Guthrie wrote a song,
It's getting really into the mainstream discourse.
Yeah, it's weird how they're shoehorning Woody into, like, as though he's a touchstone of some kind, that if you really want to know how racist Fred Trump was, Woody Guthrie wrote a song about it. That's how racist he was. So that's still coming around a lot now, which I guess, it's nice to have, nice to have found something that adds to the discussion.
But it's also one of those things that makes you think about the nature of the media and the publishing industry, isn't it? I mean, and maybe social movements and a lot of other things, but like Woody Guthrie is going to be identified forever with certain periods of time and certain songs, even though his career and his songwriting spans much more than that. And I'm sure that the same will ultimately be true of Will Kaufman and his writing. At this point, there's still a long future ahead of us, I'm sure, I hope, but inshallah. But at least at this point, you are very much associated with that particular piece of research, that particular song, at that particular time and place.
Yeah, which is fine. Every little bit helps. I was telling you before I knocked over the computer, I was just saying I just received this. So I want to mention the guy's name, Aaron Leonard. He's the one who's written this, because he's got all the gone into the Freedom of Information Act and got all the FBI files on Woody and Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes and Burl Ives and
Cunningham. Phil Oakes, right? Phil Oakes was pursued by the FBI. Turns out his paranoia was actually justified.
Yes, it was.
Duffy St. Marie was a big target as well, I think.
Yeah. I'm just looking to see if Oakes is in the... it's been so long since I've read this. I mean, I read manuscript, publishers send me, manuscripts to read to recommend publication or not. And this was one of them. But I can't remember if Phil Oakes was in it. No, he's not in it.
Okay, maybe it was something else. There was something else I read
because this only covers 1939 to 1956.
Oh, okay, yeah,
so that would have been before his, otherwise, you'd have been in there too if they extended it a little further.
Well, I did a Freedom of Information Act request to all the sort of usual intelligence agencies and heard back from all of them that they have absolutely nothing on me at all.
No, but they do in New Zealand.
Yeah, and I think they do here too.
Yeah.
Because why was I on a watch list in New Zealand, in Australia and Canada if I'm not on a watch list here? I mean, it's just obviously like they're not, you know, I mean, it's you know, it didn't start from nothing, you know, it started here. I'm sure.
But you must be just like, you know, horrified to learn that they're lying about it. I mean, I know it's a real.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, right. So shocking. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, with when I look at Phil Oakes's, like I want to touch, speaking of Phil Oakes, you know, some of his, well, I guess it was his brother, not to disparage his brother, I'm sure he's a lovely guy, but he put out an album of songs that Phil Oakes did not publish. And, you know, in my opinion, they're not very good songs, and which is probably why he didn't want to publish them, I assume. And they're all earlier songs, I think all written before he published, before he actually put out his first official album. Yeah. And I wrote a lot of songs before I put out the first album that I would care to admit to, you know, and I don't want those songs to be out there. They suck, you know. I mean, it's okay if they're in my mother's attic, you know, but, you know, I don't need to burn all the manuscripts or whatever, but, you know, I wouldn't want to publish them. But some of the stuff Woody Guthrie never published is absolutely fantastic. I mean, some of those songs. And I love, like, Ryan Harvey and Billy Bragg have both done wonderful job, or whoever, what's the band here, Billy was working with.
Wilco,
yeah. They did, I think, great jobs with great lyrics. And what do you think of the stuff that you've I mean, you've discovered stuff that Woody wrote while he had Huntington's that was really worth sharing and worth putting out there.
Yeah, there's a lot that he wrote, and the thing is, it gets increasingly difficult to read these things, because one of the symptoms of Huntington's disease is it has an impact on your use of language. It has an impact on your clarity of language, so that your language gets more and more elliptical. It gets a lot more wordplay, a lot of incoherence, really, you know, linguistic incoherence. And you can see these gems of ideas and this vision coming through so much of that. And some of the people who've looked at those later songs and done stuff with them have managed to turn them into just beautiful, you know, tapestries. Because one thing that, I mean, the Billy Bragg and the Ryan Harvey stuff all comes out of Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter, and her determination, as she said, to drag Woody out of the Dust Bowl, because he was so prolific a commentator. He wrote about everything, not just the Dust Bowl, and not just about oppositional politics either. He wrote about art. He wrote about science. He wrote about technology. He wrote about love. He wrote about nature. He wrote about so much stuff.
And that's wonderful children's music, too.
And of course, and the kids' music, you know, and that's what I noticed. That's what led me to write Woody Guthrie's Modern World Blues, because it is about his engagement with his entire world, the entire modern world that he lived in, and you know, stuff he wrote about cars. And when I was in the archives, I found after his first airplane ride, he's writing in his journal about what it was like to go up into the sky in an airplane. You know, his fascination with the experience of flight, you know, it was just delightful to read things like that, you know. But and Nora knows, because she's read everything that's in those archives, she knows that there's so much good stuff there that people can turn into gold. And so she's been having everybody who she trusts really go into the, you know, she handpicks who will be able to get their hands on her dad's stuff and turn it and to record it. And the Klezmatics, do you know, I don't know if you know, if this, the New York
fantastic band,
you know, Klezmer band, they've done two albums of Woody Guthrie stuff, you know, that had not been recorded previously in Klezmer style. because, you know, Woody was, he married into a Jewish family. Marjorie was Jewish, and he had a very Jewish sensibility. And in fact, I wrote an article that appeared in the Jewish Daily Forward about Woody's connection to Yiddishkeit. And I have to tell you a story about this because this is amazing. I was in the researching, I guess, it's 2014. It was that trip to the Woody Guthrie Archives in Tulsa, and I was there for a couple of weeks. And I'd go after the end of a hard day at the archives. I'd in the evenings I'd go out for a pint of beer with some of the other people there or not, you know. And I came home one day. I guess I was staggering home at about 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. The streets of Tulsa are deserted. So I'm coming around the corner to the Woody Guthrie Center, where I'm staying right next to it, with a big mural of Woody looking, with the guitar, this machine kills fascists, and he's looking down. It's the size of the building, right? Mm. So I turn around the corner, and Woody is looking down on a piece of cloth that appears to be tied around, that is tied around a street lamp, draggled in the mud. Right. And the street lamp is shining on it and Woody's looking down on it. And I see this thing and I get closer to it. I say, my God, it's a Jewish prayer shawl, a talis. Mm. Right. And I'm looking around and I don't know how it got there. Maybe it was a prank. It was an anti-Semitic prank. Maybe somebody was just playing, I don't know. Why would you find a talis, wrapped around the base of a lamppost and, lying in the mud? But I figured, OK, that's mine now. I'm taking it. I'm going to rescue this thing, And I looked up and Woody's looking down. He says, "You take it, boy." So I took it and I brought it home and I was in a hotel and I washed it, soaked it overnight in the basin, in the sink in the hotel. And it's clean enough, And then I phoned my my fiance, who's now my wife, the Broadway actress Judy Blazer. I don't know of you may know of her work, Judy. Anyway, we were childhood friends and, she's Jewish. I'm Jewish. And so, and we were already engaged at that point. So I phoned her up. She was in New York. And I said, "You're not going to believe what I've just found wrapped around the lamppost and Woody looking down on it. It's a talis." And she says, "We're going to be married under that talis. That's going to be our chuppah."
Of course.
When you're Jewish, you get married under a prayer shawl that's held up on four sticks and everything. So we were married under, and we call it the Tulsa Talis. And I told Nora Guthrie about that, and it sort of made
that happen. Did she have any idea where it might have come from? Did she have any insights?
No, I wrote an article about it. I told everybody, the whole Jewish community in Tulsa, know about it. Nobody owned up, so it's mine. The tale of the Tulsa Talis, and that's Woody, because Woody wrote a lot of songs about Jewish culture, the amazing mixture of Jewish foods that meets everything else in Coney Island. His mother-in-law, Marjorie's mother, Eliza Greenblatt, was one of the foremost writers in the Yiddish language working in America, and very close to Woody. And they would critique each other's work, I'd see these letters and notebook exchanges between the two of them. That's a side that Nora knows about, that's a side that Arlo knows about because he was bar mitzvahed and Woody went to his bar mitzvah. So that's there are sides, dimensions to Woody Guthrie that you find all the time. Yeah, he was just so expansive, an observer and artist, not just writer, artist. His artwork, his visual artwork, not just the cartoons that you may have seen, the line drawings in Bound for Glory, but amazing experimental watercolor, oil painting, real abstract stuff. Sculpture. He was just an artist. He was a full blown 100% artist. Is what he was. And politically driven, but not always. So that's what I'd like people to know about Woody. How expansive he really was. Yeah.
Well, in light of, you know, recently, of course, with the uprising that's been going on since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, all over the United States, there's been, of course, a lot of statues coming down. And I know that the Civil War, the American Civil War, is one of your areas of expertise. I think one of the things that's being questioned and very rigorously in many different circles, along with the icons of the Civil War and the Confederacy, is also the founding of this country by the slave owners who founded it. And then I think also about the controversy over the many decades that "This Land Is Your Land" has been the most well-known song that Woody Guthrie ever wrote. And I wonder, just this is multiple questions all wrapped up into one without really being a question, but what do you have to say about all that?
Okay. I wrote an article again in The Conversation. I think they use the title "The Misguided Attacks on This Land Is Your Land," so you can Google that. And it's about the recent discussion as to, you know, what they call cancel culture, and whether it's time to cancel Woody Guthrie because, you know, this land is not your land, this land is stolen land, you know. And because the debate is, even last week someone posted, you know, an article, should we think about making "This Land Is Your Land" the national anthem, since the Star Spangled Banner was written by a slave owner, or a slave sympathizer, if not a slave owner, I can't remember, about Francis Scott Key.
He certainly wrote a book, wrote one of those verses clearly supporting slavery and opposing anyone that would dare rebel against slavery. It's right in there in the national anthem. I couldn't believe it when I first came across that verse. Like, really?
It gets muddied up because they have the temerity to call themselves "We Never Will Be Slaves," you know, appropriating slavery as a
metaphor. Keep our slaves, but we won't be slaves.
That's right. But this discussion about Woody Guthrie, you know, and whether he was insensitive to the theft of Native American land. So I talk about "This Land Is Your Land" in the context of what we know Woody felt about Native American dispossession. And he was, you know, he was not only horrified by it, because his father was one of the agents of Native American dispossession. His father was a shifty real estate operator in Okemah, Oklahoma. He could speak Cherokee, and through his ability to speak Cherokee, he was able to divest Native Americans of much of their land. Wow. Especially when oil was discovered to be sitting under that land.
And Woody, like, in 1920 or something, the oil?
About 1920, yeah. Yeah, and then it lasted till about 1928. But all throughout Oklahoma, you know, the oil gets, and all of a sudden, and Woody has things to say about that. If you listen to the recording, "The Live Wire Woody Guthrie," which is the only commercially available recording of a complete live concert. And Woody is talking about what they did to get the land away from the Native Americans there. We know that the song he wrote, "Oklahoma Hills," which his cousin Jack Guthrie had the temerity to claim as his own. But Woody, in fact, wrote it, and I think they agreed to share the writing credit for it. But Woody was furious because one thing that Jack did when he recorded it, and was quite a minor hit, was that he left out the verse about the tribes of Oklahoma, whose land that was, and Jack Guthrie just left it out, and Woody was furious about that. He said, "This is the most important verse in the whole damn song. You know, why did you leave it out?" So we know that when Woody talks about this land being for you and me, I guess it depends on who's doing the singing, who are the you and who are the me, and or who is the me, and it's not specified. So it's a song that works in any number of contexts. I mean, there's a famous story that Pete Seeger tells about when he was at Resurrection City 1963, I think it was, in Washington, D.C. And he and a couple of people were singing, "This land is your land," you know, and they said, you know, "This land was made for you and me," you know. And then there was a Lakota activist, Chief Henry Crow Dog, who was a friend of theirs. And he came up to Pete and kind of pokes his finger in his chest and says, "You're wrong. It was made for me and you guys stole it." And all of a sudden, Pete, you know, Pete gets all, "Oh my God, I don't know if I can sing this song. What are we going to do? And, you know, Henry Crow Dog is looking at him and says, "That's all right. I'm just fucking with you. You know, just, you know, let's all sing it as long as we're here to get something done, you know."
But he's got a point, though, huh? I mean, but the founding, it comes down to the whole question of sort of patriotism and who this country was really founded for, and propaganda versus reality, right? And to what extent is the song? I know Woody's intent was very good, you know, but the how it gets understood in that context is different.
Yes. Huh? That's right, and that's why. You could have, you know, the Republican National Convention both during Nixon's time and Reagan's time singing "This Land Is Your Land." Of course, they'd leave out those three verses, which would make it rather difficult for them to sing it. You know, the verse excoriating private property, the verse excoriating the police state, and, you know, the barbed wire, you know, the wall, the big high wall there, and, you know, and all that, you know.
It's amazing. You have to leave out most of the song in order to think of the song as being some kind of a, you know, good song to sing at a Republican convention. But then I remember I was a teenager, I guess I was still a teenager. Yeah. And Reagan was running for office and using Born in the USA as his theme song. And you obviously, I mean, you have to just look at any of the verses to tell this is an anti-war song.
Yeah. Yeah. As Springsteen sort of came out and said, didn't he say something? "I heard the president was mentioning my name the other day. I guess he hasn't listened to the Nebraska album."
Yeah, or the song in question either.
And of course, that was the great, you know, this singing of "This Land Is Your Land" at the Obama inauguration. You know, this was the biggest audience that that song had ever had, you know. And regardless of whose inauguration it is, the fact that you know, Obama asked Springsteen to come down and sing "This Land Is Your Land," and Springsteen said, "Well, I'll do it if I can bring Pete Seeger along," and Pete said, "Well, I'll do it if I can sing all the damn verses." And that's what they did, you know, right into the face of, as I say, Barack Obama and the entire American power structure. They're singing that song right into their face, and, you know, could have made for some uncomfortable listening if you cared about the lyrics, you know. So I
actually had a dream about Barack Obama last night. I used to dream about Bush and Clinton a lot when they were president, but it's strange, the dreams you have. And then I woke up and look at the headlines, and he's in the headlines because Trump refuses to put his portrait up in
the White House.
In closing, can we what do you think? There's going to be an election in November here in the U.S. Any predictions? I know asking intellectuals for predictions is a terrible thing to do, but, you know, give us a prediction anyway.
Yeah, there'll be some form of an election. Whether the results will be honored is another question. You know, I don't know. Strange times.
Definitely.
Right? Strange, bloody times. But, you know, I'm going to be watching the next couple of months with a hiccup of cynicism, and you know, no matter who gets in, the government always wins.
That's right. Oh, that's a great saying. Who do you know the origins of that? I love it. That's so meme. It's a meme. Yeah. I gotta tweet that.
You don't know when you're over here on this side of the pond next, do you?
I don't know when I'll be allowed out of this country. I guess that's the question. I mean, and then of course, I guess there are ways to get out, right? I could go to Ireland. Ireland is still available if you self-quarantine for people from the US. You can, at least last I checked, you can fly to Ireland, self-quarantine for 2 weeks, and then potentially go to other places in Europe from there. But of course, the question of, if the venues are going to be open or not, if it's safe, or if they're going to be 25% capacity, because as you know, I mean, of course, it's a whole other conversation, but the music industry was already in a state of collapse before the pandemic. And it was already true that touring England for me was like a break-even proposition, you know, basically. It's no longer much of a money-making thing to tour when you can't sell CDs and the venues are shrinking. I mean, the Islington Folk Club in London is now like 25% the size that it was a few years ago because they're in, because it's impossible to find a venue, you know.
So. Yeah, and your beloved Trades Club here in beautiful downtown Hebden Bridge has not opened yet. So,
right.
So all of these places and what's happening to theater just breaks my heart, because my wife Judy is, and so we're in touch with all of her friends, all these Broadway veterans and stalwarts who are not working and don't know if they're going to see the theaters open. And the same is over here. We don't know if we'll see the theaters open, in our lifetime,
big unknown.
But we find ways.
Although Denmark seems to be doing well. If everybody could have adopted if everybody had the budget to adopt the Danish model of just sort of subsidizing the entire society until the pandemic's over.
Yeah, well, we live in hope, I suppose. But I know you have a good following in Denmark, so you may be there, but you know it.
If I'm going to be a refugee, that'll be the first place I apply for asylum.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining me for the hour, Will. It's been great catching up with you a little.
Thanks for having me, and we'll hear you later.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care.
Take care.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning into this conversation with Will Kaufman. You can find this and other discussions with David archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovix. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my Community Supported Art Program, or CSA, at davidrovix.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovix. If you're somewhere in the region of Portland, Oregon, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up for text notifications to be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response to help us mobilize against the coming waves of evictions. I've got a crowdfunder for an album project going, also known as a struggling gig economy worker employment scheme. You can check that out at davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. I'll be doing a live stream fundraiser for the album this Saturday, July 25th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. GMT. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.